Today, let's talk about adversarial friends, or maybe friendly adversaries.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I suppose, as the kids say, we're talking about frenemies. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it does fit one of the ways I wanted to approach the discussion today, which is more about a political reality. That's what I really want to get to in the conversation, and some analogies for the political reality that we sort of need our adversaries. I don't even mean sort of. We actually need our adversaries. So all the time that we spend talking about trying to eliminate all of those adversaries is not healthy time. And not just because we're anxious about it, but because we need them. I have, ages ago, and I mean when we first started doing the podcast as opposed to doing the radio show, did an entire episode or maybe series of episodes on those people, how they are also people. It's very much related to that, and it's why we need those people, the ones we want to say are so different from us. And it does fit some of the Proverbs. I'll use examples from the Proverbs in just a moment, and I mean biblical Proverbs when I say that, or some of the cliches that we use in culture, maybe an idiom or two, and, you know, a new idiom to me, as Daisy spurted it out a moment ago, of frenemies, that idea. I'm not saying it's brand new. I may have heard it somewhere, but I rejected it at the time. And so it's only just now entered my consciousness again. Anyway, the point is, we say things like this, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. I know there's more to it than that in that particular expression, but that tension between those who are of interest to you, who play a role in your life and who you need within arm's reach, and yet you know are dangerous. You know there's something about them with which you disagree, maybe even an adversarial nature to them, and that's why I keep using the word enemies here. It is about adversaries. You know, what do we do with those people who are against us in some way, seem to be undermining the very things that we care about? One of the funnier expressions of this that I know of, which I don't believe does come from Oscar Wilde. I'll simply say that because some of you would want to send me an email and say, this came from Oscar Wilde. You should have known that. Actually, I don't think it did. And it's one of those things where it's hard to find the etymology of things sometimes, or the origin of things sometimes is what I mean. The expression is, a true friend stabs you in the front. This is the... I think for a while, as I was looking up where this one came from, and this is just stuff on the internet, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but I did see where for a while in the mid-20th century, that expression was referred to as the definition of a Hollywood friend, maybe a Broadway friend, something like that. So anyway, a true friend stabs you in the front. No secrets about it. That actually is meaningful for the discussion today, because that point is important. If they were a true friend, they wouldn't stab you in the back, would they? There is some value in that statement, although I don't really want to be stabbed in either place. None of us do. That's why we use the word adversary or enemy for the kind of thing I'm talking about right now. But if I were to put it in terms of proverbs, the proverbial expressions that are given to us in Scripture, just these sort of wisdom statements, one of the expressions of it is, I found it curious that as I started looking these up, they were all in Proverbs 27. So obviously it's a thematic chapter in some ways. But this one is, better is open rebuke than secret love. That's an interesting statement, that you're served better by someone. Am I mansplaining? I mean, it's a podcast, so I sort of do mansplain all the time. But better is open rebuke than secret love. You understand that, right? So, and there is value in someone being willing to correct you publicly. And there is something maybe a little underhanded or nefarious about people who, when you need support the most, will come up quietly to you and say, you know, I'm really on your side, which we probably do trying to be encouraging or establish some kind of buttress for someone we see flailing, but in truth only says, you know, I'm on your side. I just don't want anybody to know it. I'm not sure how greatly helpful that is. Anyway, I'm not trying to expound on each of these expressions, but they are interesting. One of my favorites, the one that I came to first, the one that came to my mind first as I was trying to think, you know, where do we make expressions of what I'm trying to communicate today? The irony or the tension between friendship and adversary. And I do mean the irony where there is an attraction, actually, less, you know, tension is almost the wrong word, but a tension against the normal use of these words' meanings, because they actually do come together. The first one that came to my mind was, the wounds of a friend are faithful, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. The wounds of a friend, you know, you are wounded in an adversarial moment. Things are painful. They are against what you wanted. And yet the wounds of a friend are faithful. It's an expression of adversarial friendship, something like that. The other one, less about friendship, more about just our existence together as human beings. Iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. But the implication is you need the other person. You need the person whose honing is sharpening you, even though it may be filing some things off of you you didn't want filed off, or you wouldn't have chosen to file off yourself, obviously, because you needed another person in order to sharpen you. So iron sharpens iron as one person sharpens another. The other, leaving the biblical proverbs behind, the other expression that came to mind, and actually this was the very first thing that came to my mind, was with friends like that, who needs enemies, right? Who needs enemies? That could be the entire, you know, coverage for what I'm trying to talk about today. Literally, who needs enemies? And then to say, we all do. We all need enemies. We need the very enemies that we have. We need adversaries. And in fact, we do ourselves a severe injustice when we eliminate enemies from our lives, whether they were ensconced in the center of our lives or just beginning to crowd into the periphery of it. If we exclude people like that from our lives, and I mean find a way to eliminate them so they're not a part of it, we're actually harming ourselves. We need our adversaries. So who needs enemies? Well, let's talk about who needs enemies. And there are a bunch of different ways to get to this. And I made this point about the political system, which is really the place where I want it to be, because for us, in the discussions we had after a chapel not too long ago at Criswell College, where we had a special speaker who had written the book called Kingdom of Rage. I really appreciated the book. And so I talked about it in a few episodes and why it was important for us to understand our political system differently. But even before that, we had talked about the relationship in different episodes between politics and eschatology. And that the focus then was on the fact that the idea that we're going to produce a perfect political solution of some kind, or create some kind of paradise, or view whatever political situation we're in when it serves our interests so well, as if we're a bubble in the otherwise declining trajectory of history, that we're the magic escape bubble. We're the people who evaded that by landing in a beautiful eschaton of some kind, is not consistent with what I view as a Christian eschatology. We did a whole series on that of episodes about politics and eschatology and how they fit together to make a point very closely related to this. My point today is to expand on that a little bit with the idea of some analogies that sort of fit the same pattern, the analogies about the reality that adversarial doesn't necessarily mean harmful. Now, I do understand why an adversary is harmful. I mean, that's the point. that they are adverse to you, they are against you. But I mean real harm, that the result of it is something that's negative. And in truth, in these contexts that I'm talking about, I'm not saying there are no bad adversaries, but in these contexts that I'm talking about, we rely on an adversarial relationship to make it work. There are places where we wouldn't want to do that. I have made the point that in the medical field, where I used to teach bioethics, this comes up in biomedical ethics, I guess is how you would describe it now. In biomedical ethics, you know, a topic that comes up is what kind of model works for paying a physician and keeping the patient's health interest at the center of both parties' interest. You know, how do we get to that? And you might say, well, I mean, I don't see a real problem. You pay the doctor and they help you get better, right? It's not really a problem, is it? Well, it becomes a problem if you have, on the one hand, fee for service. So you pay me for however much service I provide you. Then a doctor has a reason to give tests to you that you don't really need to provide care for you, that you don't really want. I'm not saying doctors do that. I'm not saying doctors are underhanded. But human beings are human beings, and it creates a conflict of interest. If the way you make more money is by talking people into having more procedures, you know, maybe you should take this drug. I think you ought to give this a try. It might be something that's important for you. Oh, it doesn't seem important to you. I think it is, and it's very expensive. So, but your insurance will cover, you know, fee-for-service type things create a conflict of interest. But so do group type policies, which is called capitation. It's per head. So you give a doctor 100 patients and they get $10,000 per patient per year, no matter what. Then you have a conflict of interest in the opposite direction, because the doctor's interest would, and again, I'm not saying doctors succumb to this. I have a lot of respect for the medical professionals that I've met, and no, I think their interest is for the patient. It's why they go into the practice to begin with. However, creating a conflict of interest is a problem for anyone, anytime. And the conflict of interest on the capitation side, the opposite of the fee-for-service side, is that now you have motivation not to give them any care at all. I'm getting $10,000 from this patient if they never even come and visit me. Well, you know, give me a call and describe it. I don't think having your arm cut off really merits you having to come into the office. Get some Neosporin and a few Band-Aids and, you know, I mean, it's not like we can reattach your arm anyway. You're saving money if you don't give care. Do I know anybody that would do that? Of course not. But I'm exaggerating to make the point that it creates a conflict of interest. An adversarial relationship between a physician and a patient can also show up and create a conflict of interest when litigation becomes so common that the first thing you have to do when you go see a doctor is fill out a whole bunch of documents saying what all your prior, you know, all that stuff that you have to do so that they can treat you well. But then you also have to sign all kinds of release forms and guarantees that this and that and all kinds of acknowledgments. Well, you are aware that this hazard and this danger might come about. And the reason that all of those exist is because of all the litigation we have between patients and physicians, which sets up an automatically adversarial relationship between a lot of doctors and their patients, because the doctors don't want to be sued out of being able to practice medicine anymore, which I understand. I don't begrudge them that at all. And yet patients want to be able to sue a doctor who cut off the wrong arm. You know, when they, I don't know why we're talking about losing arms today, but it's coming up. It's just coming up. That's just the way it is. Anyway, the point is, you understand what I'm saying, creating that kind of adversarial relationship is not helpful at all. And so I can understand why sometimes people want to limit what can happen in litigation against physicians, because they don't want to set up an environment where the doctor's first concern is not the patient's health, but simply being able to keep their practice open. You know, that's a conflict we don't want. So I'm not saying every adversarial relationship is a good relationship. I'm not saying that. I am saying that I'm going to do it in three different contexts: one, judicial; two, political; and then in the church, you know, in the body of Christ. However, I think they all do relate together naturally also, not just analogously. And so but I want to give those examples because it is the case. And the judicial one is the most obvious one, because in our court system, we need adversaries in order to make it work. And it's sort of built into every judicial system. I know there are courts of inquiry instead of courts where you have you know, both a prosecutor and a defender and all that kind of stuff. But even in that setting, there is some advocacy. There is some way that you have to acknowledge the presence of adversarial positions. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the court at all. But in our court system, I mean, it's adversarial straight up. So prosecutors are on one side looking for the evidence to convict the accused. And obviously, I'm not trying to say that people are going to ignore evidence that would exonerate someone or something like that. But obviously, you all also wait until you think you have a strong enough case to even bring it to trial. So on the premise that you've gotten through all of the other steps and gotten to court, when you get there, the prosecutor's not there to help the defendant get off. The prosecutor is there to help the state finish this prosecution. We want this person punished. We want them put in jail. We want them to provide some kind of corrective. We want to provide some kind of corrective measure for them to make it right, whatever it is. Prosecutors are looking for evidence to convict the accused. On the opposite side, a defense attorney, he's not trying to undermine his defendant, his, you know, client. He's looking for evidence. She, whoever it is, looking for evidence to exonerate them. That's the point of the adversarial relationship. And the idea, by the way, that the mob, I will say mob because I mean it in the disrespectful way, that the mob gets angry when some horrible defendant, some terrorist, for instance, has a criminal defense attorney working on his behalf, and they're angry that this defense attorney would be willing to defend some terrorist. I understand the mob mentality that reacts to that, but it is a mob mentality. You need a defense attorney. You need someone to take up the defense of this person whom it's the prosecutor's job to prove is guilty. That's their job. That's what they do. And they can only do that if the defendant has somebody legitimately standing up for their interest. And then in that conflict between the two, be able to demonstrate that they really are actually guilty. And the judge, jurist, you know, whether it's in a jury, a body of jurors, or in the judge themselves, be able to determine the conclusion based on the evidence that was presented by the two sides. The point is that the synthesis of those two positions, the adversarial positions, is what preserves the interest of justice. It's not what preserves the interest of simply the society at large. It's not what preserves simply the interest of the individual who's in the court. It's what preserves the interest of justice, not just the interest of order, not just the interest of the chaos against the order, but the interest of justice. That's the point, that for justice to emerge in that court setting, the adversaries both had to play their role, and for justice to be executed in the best way possible, both adversarial positions have to be played as well as they can possibly be played. This is the point, that neither one lays down for the other side. Well, hey, you know, you're trying to prosecute my client, and the truth is, I think he's guilty too. So I tell you what, you go prosecute him, and I'll set you up with some softballs, and let's get this thing done with. That's not justice, obviously. And the justice comes when the defending attorney says, well, I'm going to work as hard as I can to defend my guy within the law. And if he's guilty, then you got to prove it. And then you prove it, then we know that the best has been done in the interest of the individual that could have been done, and yet society has been kept safe from whatever the criminal conduct was or is going to be next time, whatever. You get the idea. I mean, the picture's pretty straightforward. The inherent factors that make sense of that adversarial approach that are sort of built into our existence in a society and in Western society, and particularly here, I'm talking about the United States. That's the system with which I'm familiar. I've served on juries. I'm friends with lawyers. You know, I'm around it just that much, not much more than that. And there are inherent factors that make this adversarial approach necessary. One, I mean, the state can do whatever it wants. There are no individuals. It doesn't matter how powerful the individual is. There are no individuals who have the ability to run roughshod over the state. the state, and I'm using the word loosely. If I were using it technically, I wouldn't use the word state here. I would use the word society. So I would say the society has the power to run roughshod over individuals. They get to do what they want to do. They always have more guns because they have all of that individual's guns too. The society is the whole thing. If we're going to have any respect for the individuals that are part of a society, which the reason you have a society is because individuals need the society. If we're going to be respectful of the individuals within that society, then we have to have some process in place that defends their interest when the society wants to run over them. No. We have a procedure to go through. So I'm going to get my defense attorney out here and he's going to get in front of a judge and we're going to use the laws. And then we're going to decide whether this thing's going to happen or not. That's one. Another one is that there is a need, there is a requirement in political theory. People recognize that this is the case. There has to be some form of political legitimacy if you're going to maintain any kind of political order. Political order presumes that it's not being kept by violence, by the way. So if you're maintaining the order only through violence, you don't have a political order. The whole point of political order is that people are operating in some kind of cooperative way, right? So the need for political legitimacy in a free society means you have to have an adversarial approach in a court setting, because you have to have the means for all of the evidence to have been presented and for a reasonable person to be able to look at what both sides said and conclude that it was fair. That in some way or another, the whole interest of the society, yes, was preserved, but also of the individuals within that society. Because eventually you learn that if you can run roughshod over one person, you can run roughshod over any person. Political legitimacy requires the ability to say, I respect this society and its order, and I want to live within it without undermining it. This is why, by the way, and this is a vastly oversimplified statement, obviously. But historically, I've always been interested in Russian history. It's a part of my background in college. I wrote part of my dissertation on it, all that kind of stuff. But it is a part of why the fall of the Soviet Union, so to speak, the fall of the Berlin Wall is how we talk about it, but the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet state in the form that it was in under Gorbachev and all that, it's why it came so easily and oddly and then left behind such a disordered state that then was able to become sort of the, I'm not trying to cheaply attack another state like Russia, but I mean, it is a corrupt state in some ways, and the powers that run it, even though they do have some forms of political legitimacy, are very similar to, being a mob-run type state. Now, again, I'm oversimplifying, I know it, and I don't mean to make that as a cheap attack, but I am saying if you don't have political legitimacy, eventually the state does fall apart. The order of the state or the society does fall apart, and it has to be replaced by something else. So, the fact that the state can run roughshod over individuals, the fact that there needs to be political legitimacy, meaning respect for the way the political organization is run, the political society is run, that needs this adversarial, relationship to be present in courts. And then also just the epistemological reality about truth. Truth requires work. We don't just know the truth. Anytime I hear, to be honest, most of the time I hear it is in fiction. So it's because I'm not hanging around policemen who say this every day, right? But every time I hear this expression, which I have heard on the news also, by the way, now that I think about it, every time I hear somebody say, in my gut, I just knew he was guilty. Every time I hear something like that, I just think, man, that is not how truth works. Your gut does not get there. That is not it. The whole point of the adversarial, well, not the whole point, but the epistemological point of this adversarial requirement in a courtroom setting especially, is that truth requires effort. It requires work. It requires provocation, because we're comfortable thinking something doesn't make it right. And provocation is the only thing that can knock us off our dead center sometimes. Sometimes it requires doubt. I think this. My gut tells me this is true. He's acting like a person who's guilty. And yet there's is this niggling piece of doubt in the back of my mind? Something's going on that says, and what it provides is the opposite of what confirmation bias does to us and other cognitive biases, whether they're overt or implicit. I just feel like somebody like that's guilty. You need somebody on the other side saying, yeah, he's not, and here's why. And maybe they're wrong, but at least you get to hear the other side and then have to think through. You can understand. You get the point. In a court system, we need that kind of adversarial relationship to be able to come to just conclusions when we're going to prosecute someone for whatever's going on with them. Well, if we take that and a step forward into political systems, you might not see the direct relationship, but it is pretty direct. It's and political systems are adversarial by nature. In one sense, it's by nature because of the same thing that I mentioned about the courts a minute ago. Every political entity, every political society, a society that's run peacefully in some way, cooperative with each other, that kind of thing, every kind of society like that has an inherent conflict between the society as a whole and the individual within that society. And I don't just mean one individual, but I mean each individual within that society. Individuals necessarily require a society. So, you know, so we can have shoes to wear while we work in the fields which allow us to harvest enough corn so that we can buy shoes for the next season. Or wheels for our cart so we can get it to the market where we can get more shoes. You know, whatever it is. I'm just choosing two things to make the point. Very few people are really good at harvesting corn and making shoes. I'm just choosing two random things to make a very simple point. We need each other. And because we need each other, we need a society. And because we need a society, we need some way to be in that society without constantly being stabbed in the back. Or the front, if they're your friend, as we were talking about earlier. Anyway, the point is, society being against the individual, which is against the society, even though we need each other, and we do, we want each other, is built into the nature of any social setting. So I'm not going to rehash things that I've talked about in so many other episodes, more than simply to say the individual wants the society to restrict other individuals from causing them harm. The harm that would have come from individuals behaving without the restrictions that society has to put on every individual. So those rules that we wanted applied to everybody else suddenly come back on us and keep us from running through the red light when we want to. So now we're all tied down by these rules. So society versus the individual is just built in to existing in a society. You get the idea. If you don't, send me an email, and I'll be happy to mansplain it some more on a subsequent episode. Anyway, the second part of us being adversarial by nature within our political systems is that political groups, by definition, are against other political groups. It's not a coincidence. It is their defined role. And I don't mean by that defined like you need to fight somebody, but I do mean it that political groups form around shared interests. And interests are always competitive. Interests are competitive because they are played out in finite spaces with finite resources. So you have groups that want all the money in the businesses to be distributed to every employee equally, and it doesn't matter whether you own the business or you're working to clean the floor, you get an equal amount, an equal share of what's on that because it's all about how much you're contributing in work effort, not about how superior you are in this way or that way, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. That's the communist, you know, approach, the manifesto's statement. That kind of ideology on one side, you know, is a little bit different than the other side that would say, well, what we want to do is preserve the entrepreneurial spirit and the capitalistic spirit because we want people to be willing to take risks and to invest their skills to build industries that can employ all the people who might not have had the skills to build that entire business but can still benefit from working in such a business. Those two views are in competition with each other, and there are obviously political groups such as unions. I'm not saying they go all the way to the communist side. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying who would tend toward one end of that interest spectrum, and there are other groups who would be, you know, Young Entrepreneurs of America, I'm making up a group that doesn't exist that I know of, who would be obviously interested in the other end of that spectrum. The point being, they're in competition with each other. And because those political groups have competing interests, they are against each other. Doesn't mean they have to hate each other. We do in our world now, but we don't have to hate each other because we have competing interests. So if one political group in that context wins an advocacy, you know, we got our way, we won the election, we passed the law, we got, you know, whatever it is, the regulation changed, then another group is probably, and I'm just saying probably to be generous, it's really inevitable, they're going to lose ground in that same space. If you redistribute the money, then the people who had the money before don't have it now, and the people who didn't have money before do. So somebody wins, somebody loses. Again, I'm not saying in economics that there's no room for growth or anything like that. I believe in Adam Smith economics. I'm just making the point that in a political context, the interests are often battling against each other, and it's inherent that they have to do that almost all the time. So as an example, and this is one where there is a right and a wrong, if in the civil rights effort of the late 19th century, for instance, just regarding race, let's say that a political entity manages to eliminate barriers to certain jobs. You know what that means? It means if you eliminate barriers to certain jobs for minority groups, that a minority might be hired to do a job for which a majority person would have been hired otherwise. That's just part of what it means, right? There was that job, and that guy got it instead, and he couldn't even have applied for it in 1940, so I don't know why. One person had an advantage from the political change, and the other person had a disadvantage. You see how that becomes adversarial. Doesn't mean that the civil rights movement was wrong. Doesn't mean the person shouldn't have had an opportunity. But the fact that it was right to do that doesn't change the fact that the other guy didn't get the job now, and so he's displaced in the political context. Now, should he go out and make his own effort to find his own way, all that stuff? Absolutely. I'm not undermining any of that civil rights effort. I'm simply saying the political interests are different. That's exactly why we have seen over the past 15 years or so this we've always had this pushback, but it's been enormous and very successful. Even if you don't like it, you have to admit it's been successful, and I don't like it, and it's been successful. This enormous pushback on race-conscious admissions practices in public universities. Because the reality is, if you have a limited number of university spaces and you are race-conscious about it, hey, we want to promote the interest of Hispanic students who have traditionally not been engaged in higher education as much as we believe they would be if they had better access to it, or in the Black community, or whatever it is. If you are conscious of that when you're doing your admissions, then the reality is you're going to be making the decision to have some people from minority groups come into the university at the cost of some seats that would have been occupied by majority persons. There's no way to avoid that conflict. It's going to be there. I'm not saying that means don't bring it up, just pretend it doesn't happen. Somebody's going to be at a disadvantage, right? And I understand advocating for those who have historically been at the greatest disadvantage. Let's try to make things right with them. That's why we talk about it as leveling the playing field. I did episodes on affirmative action and why it was worth defending. I've already talked about that, so I'm not going back to it. I'm making the point that it shouldn't surprise us that in the political world, we have a naturally adversarial tension that's always going to be present because political interests are opposed to each other almost by definition, if not by definition. We can acknowledge that competition, which is what I'm asking us to do. We can acknowledge the competition even when we have good reason to advocate specifically for only one side of it. Meaning, we can acknowledge that even when our political actions really do alleviate a harm for some group or for everyone, we might say, those actions will or can, I say they will, at the same time create a hardship for a different group. We should be able to admit that. If not, and I did talk about that on the politics and eschatology series that I was talking about before, but if we don't admit that, then the circumstance, and if we didn't realize that that was the case, the circumstance being addressed by the political action wouldn't have been required to begin with. if there's not going to be a harm that comes from the thing that we do to alleviate the harm that already existed, if it's not going to create its own harm, the circumstance would not have existed to begin with. We're having to change something that was comfortable for someone that required us to pass a law or change a regulation or something like that. If you understand what I'm saying, you understand how fundamental this is to us living in a political society. So remember, we're not talking about whether it's right or not. We're not talking about which action is right and wrong right now. We're only talking about the different interests being within the society and the actions that those interests prefer to take place politically and how those are in competition with each other. We should acknowledge that that competition is always going to exist. So what we find ourselves in, as long as we acknowledge the world's not going to be made perfect by our own efforts, which is why I keep bringing up eschatology, what we're left with is this, a persistent state. This is what I think politics is always about. We just don't like to admit it, and so we pie in the sky it. We create a utopia in our minds, and we think we've arrived at it. We get one person elected, and they say, oh, the oceans are now, you know, assuaging from their, you know, all the, everything's going to be perfect now. I've heard this from one presidency after another, and I mean going back from Trump to even Biden and Obama and Bush, and people get elected and they just, oh, we have won. We have saved America. Everything's better now. And the reality is we have begun to work on mitigating some set of harms while we don't like to acknowledge, and we kind of put our heads in the sand about it, creating a different set of harms. I'm not saying they're equivalent. I'm not saying they're morally equivalent, but they're there. And we still have to deal with the fact that the people who are affected by it are our neighbors, and we've still got to live with them. So that's what we find ourselves with, this need for a persistent state of improving in one way while creating harms in another way. And then that means if we're going to be honest about our responsibility with each other, and certainly as Christians, if we're going to love our neighbors as ourselves, that means having to keep our eyes open to whatever the new problem is and then addressing that as well. And some, you know, there are times when sometimes we can probably just tweak whatever policy or action that we just created a little bit and address some of those harms. And that's a good thing. Oh, well, you know, we did this and we didn't realize we'd have this side effect. And so we're going to adjust the policy so that it only comes up to this threshold. And then we think that'll mitigate that harm. That's a great solution. When we can do that, I love the idea. But there are other times that the only real solution is going to be for the political group that was most recently exposed to that harm to become the more outspoken group. Think about how often this happens. Think back to the oscillations about abortion. When it was illegal, when Roe v. Wade was in place, now that it's not in place, all of those changes, and then the decades in which it was swinging back and forth, a pro-choice administration, a pro-life administration, oh, we're enforcing the Mexico City policy, now we are canceling the Mexico City policy, and blah, blah, blah. In all of that time, just think about how this worked. The reality of those oscillations, especially, and I think this is the prime example of it, between federal and state control. When the federal government has protected abortion rights, then states have adopted anti-abortion and pro-life policies by the boatload. Because those political powers, the political parties and the activities that took place in the legislatures there, they were motivated to overcome this oppression that they were sensing coming out of Washington, D.C. And on the opposite side, when the federal government has adopted pro-life or anti-abortion policies, then states overtly adopt these pro-choice and pro-abortion policies. By the way, stepping out of just the state's example, that's why, and I talked about this a long time ago, Israel's relaxing of requirements about abortion after we overturned Roe v. Wade was not surprising. Because the political action in interest of women's rights and things like that in Israel spikes after they see this change regarding Roe v. Wade in the United States. Political action is by its nature adversarial, advocating for those who are facing whatever harm's going on right now. And the harms can be described 100 different ways. We'll have to talk about that another time. Anyway, those changes happened because threat or exclusion or pain motivates political action. You know when it became really hard for pro-life groups to raise money? After Roe v. Wade was overturned. Then, I mean, the groups are like, well, that's how we raise money. Someday we're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. Give us money. Now it's like, well, Roe v. Wade's overturned. I guess you don't need money anymore, do you? And they're like, oh, no, that's not the case. People still need care. We still want to advocate, you know, and all that. It's a new challenge because it's threat and exclusion and pain that motivates political action. And political action represents the interest of those, you know, who are threatened or excluded or in pain. When public policy already favors your interests, what do? You work within the domain of your interest. You just go do the stuff you wanted to do. When public policy is causing you a harm that you quit doing what you want to do and you go to Washington and you work with the legislators and say, this has got to change. We have to do something. And you meet with all your friends and you say, you know, we need to elect a new representative. And you don't have to say it the same way I just said it. I'm just saying that's what we do. We react to the pressure. So you can see why it makes sense that we will always find ourselves in a world where people with adverse political opinions will be alternately active. That is, if we have a political climate that has any health in it. A political climate that has any health in it, by that I mean, if we have one that's respectful of all the people who live under its auspices, which is the point of a political society. We can live in peace with each other. If we're going to live in peace with each other, then we have to give room for the people who are feeling the pressure to say the things they're feeling the pressure about. Censoring and silencing are never going to do that. And why would we censor or silence them? Because we believe their adversarial position is something that's not helpful to our society. My point is that the adversarial position is inherently helpful to our society. Not necessarily because it wins. In fact, I wouldn't want the adversarial position to win, but I do need its pressure. I do need its recognition of something that in our society is recognized as a harm by people who are not me. Because in my lack of omniscience, I find myself needing to know things I don't. Is that smart alecky enough? Did I say that with enough sarcasm to make the point? So this point is that in much the same way we need prosecutors and defenders to make the judicial system just, we also need people on the left who are pushing us to changes we won't even consider without their input. As much as we always need people on the right who are pulling us back from those changes because we never know all the consequences of the changes we make, at least not without the benefit of perfect hindsight, which we obviously don't have ahead of time. But in this case, as it turns out, by the way, and I'll sort of wrap it up with this to make the point so far of the analogy, the judicial system isn't just an analogy. It's also, you know, sort of in mathematical terms, it's also something of a fractal, right? It's a portion of the whole, and it reflects the whole as well. The criminal courts are a piece of our politically adversarial system. It provides a venue for the persistent contest between the rights of the individual and the individual's obligation to society, or, in other words, between the interest of society as a whole and the interest of the individual who lives within that society. That's why cases are often titled the state of such and such versus John Doe or vice versa. It is the society versus the, you know, individual or even corporation or something like that. Now, what I want to do next, and this is what we'll set up, and then we will, for the second episode of this little series, talk about this in more detail and then come back and create the analogy in a lot more detail, is the comparison that has with the body of Christ. Now, that may sound strange to you, but it is built into us. There are differences built into the body of Christ that we're supposed to appreciate. And when we say that in terms of the gifts, and I'll give more information to this next time, I'll give more detail to it next time. But the difference is when we recognize them simply as gifts, you know, it's all a children's birthday party to us. Oh, everybody just get along, you know, it's all just wonderful, it's all fine. But when those differences are reflected in the personalities of leaders, for instance, Peter and Paul, which we'll talk about next time, just briefly to make the point, or when it's a difference in purpose, it can become adversarial. And I know we'd like to say, well, in the church, it should never be adversarial, but it is sometimes. And sometimes it's that in the New Testament, it's adversarial. And it's helpful because it reshapes what we're doing together in a way those of us as individuals who are settled in the way we're going already would never have adopted without that adversarial pressure. So, you know, who needs enemies? We all do. We all need enemies, and we need them for a lot of reasons. Reasons we'll carry on about more next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.